Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the podcast. We're super excited to have on Steve Krein, who's been a longtime family friend, a friend of my dad forever. He's also the CEO, co-founder, and managing partner of Startup Health, which is on a 25-year mission to invest in a global army of entrepreneurs to solve 11 health moonshots that would improve the health and well-being of everyone in the world. And we'll talk about a bunch of those. He's also a serial entrepreneur, speaker, investor, advisor, and entrepreneurial coach. He's done a ton of keynote speaking. Outside that, he's co-founded and led several technology companies, including Organized Wisdom, Promotions.com, and Webstakes, which was a global online advertising, direct marketing, and tech company, which he took public on NASDAQ and grew to a $500 million market cap before it was acquired in 2002. Steve, thanks so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Jess, thanks for the intro. Hey, Brian.
I'm really excited about this interview with Steve. Number one, because Steve and I have been really close friends since our 20s. And we'll tell the backstory on that. And Steve has a very fascinating and varied background. But also what makes Steve like an awesome person to interview is Steve lives a great life and he's a great person. And he's not one-dimensional at all. And I think there's a pathway that led there that didn't start in that place. And I think that he could give you a lot of amazing insights that hopefully heads off mistakes that many young entrepreneurs and startups make. So I'm excited to do this interview today.
And I'm excited to be here because as many podcast interviews and interviews I've done, I've never been interviewed by a father and son. And both knowing you both so well and your accomplishments, I'm excited to be among the first guests on your new podcast series.
Yeah, thanks for doing it, Steve. I guess, could you give us a brief rundown on how we ended up here 30 years probably after meeting my dad, just from setting the stage on that, and then I'd love to get into a little bit of your history.
I mean, the real history is that my wife, Rebecca, and your mom and Brian's wife, Helene, were roommates in college and met actually, I think, prior to freshman year. And having them so close, and then, of course, Rebecca being there, not only the night that your mom and dad met, but actually lived with your mom and then lived with, I think, a little bit of you too, Brian, here in the city. I had the privilege of, within the first, I think, two dates of going out with Rebecca, having a chance to meet you guys. And so I think it was a fast friendship and kindred spirit because I have, for as long as I can remember, always been loving time spent with entrepreneurially minded people and entrepreneurs. And I think probably in our first meeting, your dad and I got pretty close pretty quickly by just riffing on and talking about the businesses that we were both building and what we were doing. And I think found a lot of commonality in our values and our visions and how we saw our lives playing out. But we were so, I think, now young looking backwards at that moment. But I think there has been just a common value system, both family, business, and personal, that has always existed and I think driven a lot of the development of our parallel lives over the past, you know, it was 27 years.
Yeah, I think, and I want to dive into that entire process of you guys meeting and going through that journey over literally the last 30 years. I guess to start where we are now and move backwards, could you give everyone a little bit of a background, what Startup Health does and where you've been spending your time the last decade or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think to tell the story of Startup Health, I do think it requires me to go back to my childhood, because I think a lot of what has defined my life has been this idea that I can create my own freedom and I'm in control of my own destiny. And a lot of that was driven by things that happened when I was a young boy in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, growing up and having a very non-entrepreneurial family. I mean, my dad was a sales guy at a tire engineering company. My mom was, you know, at first a dental hygienist and then a nurse and then a physician's assistant. And I think they ingrained in my brother and my sister and I, I'm the youngest of three, this idea that the only thing that was certain in life was that an education couldn't be taken away from you. And so get one and you'll have safety for life if you become a lawyer or a doctor. They didn't know much about MBAs or business school or businesses. So it was for them, just become a lawyer or doctor. And so I think from the earliest of ages, I remember hearing that. And then my father got laid off from his job when he was about 50 years old. I think I was probably around 10 or 11. And I vividly remember them sitting us down to tell us that my dad was laid off. And it was almost like that moment that, and still impacts me today when I think back as to that idea of education can't be taken away from you. My dad got laid off and he said, "See, we told you, you could lose your job, you can lose a lot, but had I been a lawyer or a doctor, I wouldn't have been getting laid off like that." And that was kind of the narrative that would then define, I think, every step I would make from that day forward. And so whether it be from that day forward, starting to sell blow pops to the kids in school or mow lawns or deliver papers, I just forever was moved by this idea that I'm not going to be the one that gets late, quote unquote, laid off or fired by someone. And although I wasn't given much choice of a quote unquote education besides being a lawyer, becoming a lawyer or doctor, I was very entrepreneurial from that moment forward. And I was really always wondering why the idea of being the business owner, which I don't think was called or we knew as an entrepreneur at the time, I just saw that as kind of the defining call to action for my life. And I think even though I didn't realize it then, the seeds were planted as to making sure whatever I do and wherever I go, I was going to make sure I was making decisions to be at the top of the food chain, so to speak, and have the ability to be the one that defines my life. And I think as it played out over the subsequent years in college, the jobs I had, the things I did were very entrepreneurial. In law school, which of course my brother went to medical school, my sister went to law school, I went to law school. But even in law school, I was very entrepreneurial and I sought out the professor that was doing business stuff. And in particular, going to the mid 90s, doing stuff online. And I was really fascinated by the lawyer in the professor in law school who was doing a business on the side. He had a law practice, he was a professor, but he also had this business on the side. And so him and I really connected. And I finally found an entree into how I could, while getting my law degree, start to really dabble in entrepreneurship in a real meaningful way. And before I keep going and tell you the rest of it, I think when I look back again, connecting dots historically, I think it was this theme of being entrepreneurial and being in charge of my own destiny that was sown by these lessons that were both narratives that I heard, but also what I got to see and how difficult it was for my father to come back from that in terms of just jumping from a lot of different jobs and jobs and jobs after that point in time. But I just saw how I was really determined to define and design a life that would be my choice, not somebody else's.
Steve, did you ever go on to practice law before your first, you know, experience with the Law Journal?
No. In fact, I ended up in my beginning of my third year of law school in Delaware, which in Wilmington, Delaware, there was clearly a unique moment in time, and it was the birth of the internet. It was 1994. The idea of Netscape going public and this rush to build online businesses was starting to emerge. And while talking to this professor, he showed me an ad in the paper, the actual physical paper, the New York Law Journal, National Law Journal, which was published daily at the time. There was an ad for a online publisher of their online platform called Law Journal Extra. And it was September of my third year. I ended up getting on a train, making a phone call, getting on a train and going up to New York in September of my third year, getting a job offer on the spot because of my background and my experience with, you know, by the way, with this professor building a little online service in Delaware with him, but really getting a chance to move to New York and build this online service. And actually, what the publisher of the Law Journal guaranteed me was that he would help me come to law school and finish my third year here up here in New York at Cardozo. And so I spent my entire third year of law school, half of it commuting from Philadelphia to New York, the second half living in New York, and then graduating in May of 1995 or June of 1995 with no intention of practicing, but actually working and building an online platform for lawyers. And I saw the pathway, quite frankly, to entrepreneurship through that. And had no intention really of ever practicing other than making sure my parents knew I got my law degree and that education could never be taken away from me. And so, no, the answer to the question is no, I didn't. But I really rejected that whole notion of doing it because my parents said, but at least acknowledging that I was going to get the degree and then go do what I want to do.
I think all of this stuff is interesting. And I was just talking about with my dad prior to recording this, like, I look at you as like a second entrepreneurial father who's been through the process. And I think there's a lot of valuable stuff I've learned from you that I want to share with people in the time we have. Going back a little bit to taking your company public, how old were you? 29, 30?
Fast forward, you know, I graduated in the summer, you know, I guess May, June of 95. I got funding to start my first company that fall from the publisher of the Law Journal. And that company was Webstakes. We actually started as Netstakes, but became Webstakes. And then I built that company from 1995 through 99, which when we went public, and then we sold it a couple years later. But I was 29 years old when we went public. We had raised probably close to $50 million at the time. We went public at probably a $250 million market cap, and it doubled or more from there. But that journey of being a 25-year-old, quite frankly, novice entrepreneur who just had done small businesses and small jobs to this quickly growing multi-million dollar revenue company, a couple hundred employees, a company worth hundreds of millions of dollars. This was all happening in the span of just a couple of years. And in fact, your father became a catalyst to a couple of things that led to me being able to even get to the place where I was taking the company public. And it was actually a conversation we had a couple years into building Webstakes when I think we were at, I want to actually say it was a brunch for one of our friends where Brian, you were telling me about, you were seeing how hard I was working. I was working 7 days a week. I think I broke away. I was probably, although there were no cell phones at the time, probably working while we were at this brunch. And you said to me, I need a coach. And you had just started Strategic Coach, Dan Sullivan's program. And you were telling me about just a couple of themes, one of them being around getting some free time. The other one about accomplishing impossible goals and really getting a little bit of semblance of recalibrating. I remember the word recalibration, and it was taking a deep breath because I was just so immersed in this rocket ship of the internet, this rocket ship of a company. But I was clearly, as you could probably tell, and I'd love to hear your version of it, Brian, I was clearly visibly on the way to burnout because I couldn't possibly work any more hours. I couldn't possibly be any more dedicated. That doesn't mean I was doing it all smart, but you saw something that I think was one of those inflection points that easily changed the trajectory of not only that company, but my life.
So my recollection is that I always thought you were a good dude, but you were way fatter than you are right now. You're much thinner, much better, much more healthy, much more present human being. And at the time, you looked like a lot of the entrepreneurs I've met, you know, and business owners over the years, which was just, you know, somebody very, very stressed and very, very unable to disconnect. So what I'd be interested in maybe digging in a little bit on is there's two pathways I'd like to go down. One is at Webstakes, you did have to obviously raise capital, and you also had a primary advisor. And I believe that the person's name was Harry. Yeah. And there's always been, outside of the coaching, which we're talking about now, you've always had mentors. And those mentors have been in the role of board members. Can you like share some stories about like, how did you meet Harry? What are some of the most profound things that you discovered from working with him as a mentor? And then let's move over to Dan Sullivan, Strategic Coach, and things of that.
Well, I think any mentor, and I really fashion them more like coaches than mentors, have been present in my life for as long as I can remember. And even although I remained until my father passed away incredibly close to my father and respected his value system and what he did to teach me how to be a great father, model a great grandfather, and so forth, I always found that I had to try to collect other wisdom and experiences from everybody around me. And I remember even in college or law school, and in fact, the professor at law school, Mr. Herman, who I'm still in touch with, I kind of end up connecting with people who have unique abilities that I admire. And they might not have everything that I admire, but they have certain unique abilities that I admire. And I've always found connecting with those people to be more like this mini coach around a particular topic or so forth. And so Mr. Herman played that role in law school, and he was actually very helpful in helping unlock my parents' permission for me to move to New York. When I started working at the Law Journal, I found the same thing in a guy named Joe Lamport and Jimmy Finkelstein. And then when I was launching Webstakes and building that company, I was lucky enough through my sister to get introduced to a through one of her very close friends, this guy named Harry Carneal, who was in Dallas, Texas. And it was one of these serendipitous moments where he was looking to get involved in investing in the internet, just in the internet. And we had an interesting internet company that was really designed to do direct marketing and technology enabled promotions for companies. And he was introduced. I went down very quickly at the request of him. He paid for the plane ticket. I went down to Dallas. And as soon as I met Harry, he had this really, he had this great accent, a Texan accent, almost like a cowboy. He had a great mustache, one of those nice handlebar mustaches. And he had a very kind disposition. But what I noticed is that he was very calm in how he was looking at investing, even though I looked around me. And at the time, by the way, in 1996, the world was, you know, exploding around the internet and a lot of hype cycle stuff, but he was calm, cool, and collected. And it began with a simple thing of like, let's split a sandwich at the barbecue, which then became just a dialogue around always treating people fairly and always being in sync with whoever it is you have around the table to help you. And I knew over a lunch in a matter of just a couple of hours that I had met someone who could be incredibly valuable in sharing his unique ability with me. And it's a theme that I've seen. By the way, I have probably hundreds of these coaches in different ways. I have some that obviously become much more impactful than others. But I've always seen advisors, mentors as coaches as integral to everything that we do and I do. And it, again, is specific to just a philosophy of choosing people who give you energy or give me energy, who I get energy from, and I think I give energy to, that make me, and I think force me to look at who I need, what I need, and hopefully bring people around me that are aligned with whatever it is that I'm doing. And Harry, quite frankly, was all about syncing vision at the time. That has evolved for me into syncing mission. And so it's one thing to say, you know, what I wanted to build in 1996 was a IPO-able multi-billion-dollar company. What I want to build now is an organization, a community, and an ecosystem, and really a global army of entrepreneurs who want to, you know, solve some of the biggest health challenges in the world. And so I am looking for every day people who want to be on the same mission and solve the same kinds of things that I do. And so vision alignment, mission alignment is a theme over the last 30 years. And whether that's a mentor, whether that's a coach, whether that's a team member, whether that's an investor, that's just a common theme that I think was taught to me by Harry, quite frankly. Like that idea of let's sync on where we want to go. And that has changed my perspective of entrepreneurship.
From more of a tactical standpoint, I think my dad here does a good job on getting his Gandhi theoretical stuff, which is all important. But I wanted to talk a little bit about, I remember vividly, we were down the shore a couple summers ago. And you were talking about the process when you IPO'd. And we had a long conversation on collaring stock versus not collaring stock and what that process looks like. So I want to sort of contrast that. I had a conversation with Mark Cuban about literally the opposite when he did collar his stock. And I know we talked about it, me and you. Could you talk a little bit about what that process was like when you IPO'd? Stuff you'd change if you could, and sort of your advice to founders who might be going through that process?
Oh, God. I mean, I want to be careful here. I mean, I think at the end of the day, I remember getting some advice after we IPO'd around a practice around, from what I remember and understand, and I'm not a securities lawyer and don't want to go down this path of misinterpreting this, but the idea of agreeing to sell your stock at a certain price, and it locks in your upside and your downside. And the idea was that a lot of entrepreneurs back in the day, and I don't even know if it's still possible the same way, but you put in automatic selling at a price, regardless of what the price is. if you collar it, you kind of lock it in, and you were locking in, locking out both upside and downside. For Mark Cuban, by the way, it worked out great. He collared it, and I think he got was able to lock in at a high value. I think for me, you know, I was given the advice of making sure that, and this was again conflicting advice from different people at the time, of being careful to signal your long-term commitment to the company and all this stuff. And what I've kind of taken away from this whole practice over the years is, like, you know, equity value of companies, you know, back in the day, you know, internet companies, you take Mark Cuban's broadcast.com, or you take what I was in Webstakes. If you take what happened in crypto a few years ago, or if you look at what happened in lots of companies and lots of, you know, high tech spaces over the last several years, is that there were really, really inflated valuations on companies. And for people who are really financially savvy, they're really know how to manage that and take advantage of that. I think I have always been and have stayed this mission-driven entrepreneur, and I've kind of been always long companies, long equity, held onto stock, even to a fault, by the way, in my companies. And I know lots of people who've done the opposite. They get in, they get out, they do transactional. And I think I've now learned what the difference is between thinking transactional and thinking transformational. I couldn't say that at the time, but I now know. I have been almost in my DNA a transformational guy. I am always thinking about long-term transformation, impact, staying in the game. There's much smarter people than I am around this idea of just doing transactions and knowing the right prices, the right values, get in, sell, do all this stuff. And I've always felt, especially where I've spent the last 15 years of my life in healthcare, that if you're really going to accomplish big, meaningful things, you got to build businesses that are sustainable, that generate cash flow, and that long-term can really be valuable, and that you will have optionality to do whatever you want down the road. I think the idea of a 29-year-old kid going public, or you see this with crypto and lots of things, these are like values and net worth tied up in things that are just paper. And at the time that you're getting that position, do you have the right advisors around you and the right people around you to help guide you through it? I wouldn't change a thing looking backwards. There's many people that would, you know, oh, I wish I sold at a different price. I wish I did this at a different price. But I kind of subscribe to the blissfully ignorant view that everything happens in life the way exactly the way it's supposed to happen, and that the lessons you learn throughout life or all through these different things that you experience. And so for me, that IPO was like practice for what I'm doing now. I think every good and bad experience I've had over the last 25, 30 years as an entrepreneur has done the same thing. And so I think very transformationally in terms of being involved with my company, our companies. I think my partner Unity feels the same way, probably to a fault in some way on terms of just being financial focused. But I think for us, it's been just thinking about these types of long-term relationships is more enjoyable and more fun to do in the long term. Again, I mixed the two a little bit, Jesse, on there, but I definitely am not the transactional thinker. Never was. I don't think I ever will be.
What would 52-year-old Steve tell 21-year-old Steve, knowing what you know now?
Take a deep breath and enjoy the journey. But not because I didn't, but because I think I did learn that practice over time. I think I stressed about a lot of things over the course of the last 20 or 25 years to continue to remind myself everything happens the way it's supposed to happen. And I think, I don't know if you said 20 or 25-year-old Steve, I feel like I have lived both my personal life, my business life, my relationship with my family, my children, my wife, my parents, my siblings, my nieces, my business partner, I think, always tried to live and be present and be batteries included. I, you know, go back to Dan Sullivan and some of the early lessons that were embedded in us in that program, Brian. But I feel like I got a gift the year I joined Strategic Coach that I think helped me be able to answer that question emphatically, like I wouldn't change a thing. Because I was 20, I think I joined Coach when I was 28, a year after, you know, maybe 6 months after you told me. I was obviously, you know, I wasn't committing to Rebecca at the time. She was just a girlfriend I was, you know, seeing at night when I got home for a couple hours. I was, like you said, probably 35 pounds heavier. I think I was spinning around in circles. And Dan Sullivan did that lifetime extender exercise. In fact, I just did this a couple of days ago with my YPO forum, where the question is, how old are you going to be when you die? And, you know, for a 28-year-old kid being asked that question, besides it rattling me, I kind of was like, oh, I don't know. My grandfather lived till he was 85. I don't know, 85. And the people in the room, I remember the entrepreneurs a lot older than me, you know, in their 40s and 50s being like, you know, answering, you know, the same thing. Maybe it's 75, 85, 90 based on family history. And I remember the question that we were asked to do, which is, if you could describe your life when you're 85 on your deathbed, you know, what would your life look like? And you go and you describe your, you know, life physically, financially, spiritually, relationship wise. And then they're like, well, if you could have some extra years, how many extra years would you like? And I think I said, maybe give me 5 more years again, if they could be healthy. And what would you do during that time? And I'm like, oh my God, I would be in a loving relationship with my wife, and we'd have children, grandchildren. I'd be working on a meaningful business. I would be present with my family and friends. I would be working on a meaningful business. I would be healthy and thin and, you know, eat well and do all the, and I described all this stuff. And then the punchline to this whole exercise, I think, set the stage for the last 25 years of my life, which was, well, do it now, or do it over the next couple of years and set your life up to do that. And so whether it was in that session, the plan for the IPO, the plan to get engaged to Rebecca, the plan to really make sure that I was only working with people that I liked, and all the things that I think I did in the subsequent 3 years from that workshop really allowed me to build the life I want. And although every experience doesn't go exactly the way you want, go with the flow with it. And so I think the aspect of my health, the aspect of my family, the aspect of what I spend my time in and unique ability, the access, kind of business I'm building, and the kind of wealth I'm creating are all tied to that question when I was 28 years old. So if I hadn't been asked that question and I hadn't gone through that, I don't know how my life would have turned out, because I was so focused on being intentional with it.
It's funny. We just, and I'm not going to get long-winded about it, but we just rewatched a show called The Devs. And what's fascinating about it, if I was going to summarize the whole thing, is that it's a coder's wet dream. What's a coder's wet dream? To basically unlock the code of the universe, right? That this is all code and it can be discerned. And once you discern it, you can basically, everything becomes deterministic, right? So the insight that it gave me after watching it, thinking about it, losing my father-in-law recently, and pondering a lot of like, what's the meaning of the life stuff. And I thought, you know, what differentiates us from just an animal running around, right? We've got a prefrontal cortex. And what does a prefrontal cortex allow us to do? Well, we have the ability to imagine what isn't. They're stuck in the present moment. So they may be happier than us because they're immersed in whatever the scene is. But what we have been given, which is a godlike capability, is we can imagine something that has never been and create it. And this concept that you discovered in your 20s, and I did too, that this, they talk about manifesting and goal setting and all this stuff that people think is woo-woo, right? But it's the one thing that takes you off of sleepwalking through life. Because what it allows you to do is dream up something that could be your dream, whatever that dream is. And you may be wrong. You may get it wrong, but it gives you a vision and it takes you off of the deterministic track that you're on and opens up a world of opportunity that you can bring into reality. And the only thing that I'm curious, based on having done this for 20 some odd years, I've done this for over 20 years, is, what is a surprising insight that you've had from goal setting for the last 20 years? Like, what did you think it would do for you that it didn't do for you? And what is a surprising thing that it did do for you?
First of all, love the way you describe that. I have this image. So I just came back from a few days in Panama with my YPO goals forum that we've been in for 20 years. So I've been meeting every quarter for 20 years with the same group of entrepreneurs. There's six of us, started out as 10, but it's six of us that have been with probably 16 of the 20 years. We've been the only six. A couple of people dropped out pretty quickly. And interestingly enough, there's some insights into the people that dropped out, not naming names, but just the difference between the habit of thinking about your life in quarters. like in four quarters a year, every 90 days. And quite frankly, I learned that when I was taking the company public, and the accountants were like, yeah, we got to look quarterly at all these different things. And I was like, oh shit, I have to be accountable on a quarterly basis to my business, to my investors, and to things like that. And then when I got into strategic coach, it was the same thing, quarterly increments, recalibrate every quarter. And so what I've noticed is that, and it was another coachism, I hate to say, which is, I remember very vividly when Dan Sullivan was talking about a 25-year vision. And that seems really daunting when you're 28 years old or 29 years old, until he says, well, 25 years is really just 100 quarters. So you have 100 iterations, 100 times to look at what's working and what's not working and who's helpful and who's not helpful. And whatever it is you're trying to create, it doesn't have to happen overnight. You got plenty of time to do it. And so giving an entrepreneur that kind of permission to take the time and think incrementally was a game changer, right? And so what I've noticed about goal setting, and we were just talking about this as a group the other day, is that it lets you check in and step back. And we use these five categories in our goals group. And actually it was modeled after that goal cultivator exercise in strategic coach, which says, look at your health, look at your family, look at your personal, look at your business, and look at your money every quarter, and just check in. And if you have a 25-year framework, you might have a 10-year kind of goal. Then you have a one-year goal that kind of aligns with the 10. Then you have 90-day goal that aligns with the one-year goal that aligns with the 10-year goal. And all of a sudden, everything starts to cascade from that framework. And so if it's about losing weight, if it's about building a business, if it's about relationships with your family, if you can't name exactly what you want, where you want to be 90 days from now, is it, you know, not being 175 pounds, but it's exercising every morning for at least 45 minutes, whether that means a walk, a run, a weightlifting, you know, doing yoga, practicing, whatever. If you don't have any of those habits built into your kind of 90-day plan, don't expect to wake up and weigh 175 pounds if you're 210. And so the incremental habits, the incremental behaviors, what I've noticed over the last several decades is it's fascinating how there's evidence it works. Everybody who kind of subscribes to identifying what needs to happen and committing to doing that achieves results. And those that don't. I mean, yes, maybe sometimes you get lucky, you have something happen, but it's a much different kind of day-to-day when you kind of set up the tracks to run on. And I've noticed in this goals forum, the massive accomplishments, massive, not just in the billions of dollars, but in the 50, 60, 70 pounds of weight, in the health, in the longevity, in the relationship quality, in the business quality, in the friendship quality, in the joys of life quality, between this group as an example and other groups I'm a part of where I don't see the practice. And so to your point of like coders coding life, like there's some pretty simple wisdom and instructions on how to do it your way, but do it within this construct. I'm just blown away how few people do it and truly do it. And it's not perfecting it, it's just a practice.
It's like, Jess, to use your generation's term, it's like going from a non-playable character to taking control and becoming a playable character and then making decisions, right? It literally transforms the quality of life because you become intentional. And there's two nuances, Steve, that you pointed out that I don't think a lot of people understand. You do not goal set from today forward. You literally rotate into the future, and then you inhabit something in the future that you would like to be and bring into reality, and you literally get pulled towards it. And the way that you get pulled towards that reality is by then working backwards from the end event. And what actually occurs, which you were pointing out, but I think there's a term for, is your identity changes. You identify as the end result or the end vision instead of today's vision. And by inhabiting that different identity, you make the choices or the habits of the guy who's got a six pack, of the guy who has a $1 billion company, of the person who's in a happy relationship. What would they do? How might they handle the situation? And you start to decide from that place as if you're already that person. And you become that person. And it's like magic.
It appears like magic to some people, or some people think it was overnight. but it's never, never overnight. It's this continual, you know, push towards it. The other practice, by the way, that I think I've mastered, but can always do better, is ironically this notion of measuring progress and the notion of how do you show up every quarter to a group of other entrepreneurs who you shared your goals with and what you wanted to achieve, and how are you measuring yourself? And another, go back to Danism, was this idea of the gap and the gain. Don't measure yourself by where you haven't gotten to, measure how far you've come. And so we have a practice in our goals forum of not looking at, oh man, I missed that goal. It's, did I make any progress from where I was last quarter? And I think this idea, whether it's weekly, whether it's monthly, whether it's quarterly, whether it's annually, whether it's over 5 or 10 years, are you making personal progress? Not compared to other people, but compared to where you were. And I always loved and appreciated, and I probably think about this on a regular basis, daily basis, that image of the idea you're sitting on a beach and you're looking out at the horizon and it looks really far away, like any goal that you set does typically. And if you were to get into a boat and start paddling out towards the horizon, you would continue what, right? Continue to see the horizon move. You never get any closer. But if you look back after 10 minutes of rowing, the beach is, you know, a little far away. And then you kind of row for another half hour, couple hours, and you look back and the beach is even smaller. And you keep rowing. And although the horizon doesn't look any closer, the beach is gone. And so whether it's about relationships or your business or things, I've learned and tried to make sure I practice that idea of the progress you make and be happy with, excited about, and celebratory about the practice you make. And I got to tell you, I was at the CEO summit I told you over the past 2 days, and I saw two people that embodied this. One was Julia Roberts. And Julia Roberts was interviewed on stage. Great interview. And I've never seen her interviewed live except for like on Oprah or any of those TV shows. And the guy that was interviewing her, was a master interviewer, asked about how she feels when she does movies that are panned or nobody goes to see them. And her answer basically was, every movie I do is a learning lesson. Every movie I do is a joy to do, even if there's not things within that movie that are not a pleasure. And I have rose-colored glasses when I go back and look at any movie I've done in any part of my career. And I'm just proud of the experiences that I have. And she's like, that's what I've chosen to do with the way I look at movies. There's other actors who will be caught up with a bad movie they were in, bad acting they did. She's like, I have just made the decision since my earliest days as an actress to just look at every single movie, good or bad, experience. I don't pay attention to people not seeing it. There's some movies I do for people don't even know why I did them. One was about the opioid crisis. And she's like, that's not a movie anybody wants to see on a Friday night. I didn't care. I did it for my reason. So that was one perfect like example of like looking at progress you're making and just looking at each one leading to another. The other person was James Cameron, which I mean, I couldn't believe that we got to see him interviewed for an hour about his journey from being a sci-fi, you know, movie guy with Aliens and Terminator and all this stuff to doing a love story with the Titanic with this historical perspective, which actually paved the way for the Avatar. And he told the story of the fact that decades ago, he actually wrote down the whole thing for Avatar. He drew pictures. He did all the stuff. There was no technology there. He didn't have any credibility in Hollywood at the time. Nobody would ever bet on him. But he knew he'd have these building blocks to get there. And every little thing he did led to the next. And then the Titanic, which obviously was different than any other thing he had done in his genre, opened up all of the movie studios' willingness to take a guy like that and give him hundreds of millions of dollars of budget to do something where they would create technology to actually help him. And both of those were like just progress baby steps, but he chose to look at every single little thing as a leap of faith to the next thing. And that's been a great framework as you think about goal setting or anything else, like just let it play out. But again, how you look at each of these experiences plays directly into it.
You talk to probably so many young founders every day or every week who are going through the startup health process. And you kind of answered this before on the advice you'd give to yourself. But when you see somebody come in, what are telltale signs that you think, hey, this person has a shot in entrepreneurship, or it's somebody I'd bet on? And what do you think those people should be self-reflective on when going through a process of either starting a business, deciding to start a business, or what's pursuing their career. So think somebody my age, graduating school this year and trying to figure out what to do next.
The telltale sign of a good entrepreneur, a successful entrepreneur, and actually who I work with don't necessarily correlate always, because I'm much more picky about who I work with than just, are they going to be a great entrepreneur? And it's really about who you want to spend your time with, or who I want to spend my time with, or my team wants to spend their time with, or who other entrepreneurs would want to spend their time with. And I really, and this is, by the way, about entrepreneurs. This is about my friends. This is about my team members. This is about investors. This is about coaches or mentors. I look for people who have a mindset that I believe is both transformational, but also growth oriented. And transformational and growth oriented together, because it's growing, but it's also meaningful progress towards things, coupled with their energy, being batteries included, are the two filters that filter people in and out of my life. And so people that have either a failure mindset, or they're really frustrating to be around, or their batteries not included, draining energy, are just the simplest filter, regardless of who they are or what I think they're able to achieve. I meet incredibly successful people that I wouldn't want to spend an hour with. I wouldn't want to spend a day with. And I know nobody around my universe would either. And so we have filters set up around a mindset scorecard that we've developed on the kinds of people we believe not just can make meaningful progress as entrepreneurs, but are the kind of people other people want to be around. Investors will want to back them. Advisors will want to advise them. People will want to work with them. And only because it's very fresh in my mind, it's kind of like the NPS score, like, you know, the Net Promoter Score that people use for customer service. And in every experience, and for those who aren't familiar with NPS, Google it or put it on ChatGPT and learn about it, because the Net Promoter Score is a score of 0 to 10. And it basically asks you to rate the experience you had, having a service provided, going somewhere, meeting someone. And if you give this score, if you would, it's kind of like, I think the question is, would you recommend this service or product or think company to a friend or a colleague, right? It's that simple. Recommend. And so if you think about the kind of people we choose to be with, it's people we would want to recommend to other people, have a high NPS score. And so the mindset scorecard, the transformational mindset, the batteries included, are at the very front of this filter. Behind that, there's lots of different dimensions to the kind of company they're building, the kind of organization they're envisioning, the kind of person they are, the kind of other things. But at the very beginning, and I think it's worthy of stopping and pausing and talking about this for a moment, because it's the most underestimated of all filters people have. Who do you want to spend time with? And if you don't think one person can bring you down, trust me, they can. I see it every day. Choosing the wrong board member, choosing the wrong investor, choosing the wrong spouse, choosing the wrong friend, choosing the wrong business partner, literally can erase decades of your life, can ruin businesses, can ruin so many things. So be choosy, be selective about who you surround yourself with. And if you go back to that question about 20-year-old Steve versus now, I knew that in my late 20s. It took me years to have the courage and conviction to literally make it a rejection from day one. I just don't want to be involved with those people. I'm not perfect at it. Sometimes other people see it and I don't. And I hear from my team about somebody that they're pretty batteries not included. I'm like, wow, they're not to me, but they are to other people. And so look around at the multiple interactions you have with people and just be religiously protective of anybody around your universe that isn't batteries included and doesn't share the same mindset you have.
Steve, you know, I'd like to spend a moment on what I think a lot of young entrepreneurs get into the game for. Like, I do think a lot of them probably do have a vision. They maybe something pisses them off, right? Like, there's a lot of amazing businesses that were started because something irritated somebody deeply. I mean, and maybe it was a really big freaking problem, right? That could help millions or billions of people. What do you think a good reason for starting a new business is? What do you think a realistic insight into like what you're putting yourself into if you choose to go down this path versus taking like a high paid job of some sort? And when is it worth it? And then the last part I want to add to it is that a lot of people, like, we're talking transactional, transformational. Well, I've noticed that there are people that can be, you know, like obsessed with something for their entire lives and stay with it. And then there are people who do 10 turns and they're making 10 exits, right? How do you know who you are and how do you make those kinds of decisions?
Yeah. So in my goals forum, there are people who are transaction junkies and they know how to do deals. And their unique ability is doing deals. And so the more deals, the better, the lessons, the learning, the exits, all that stuff comes from living in a unique ability of doing deals. But that's transformational too, right? Because if their 30 years or 20 years or career, whatever, is their unique ability is doing transactions and it brings them joy and excitement and they love the thrill of it, by and large, lean in and be that. I think that knowing whether you're that or not as early in your career as possible, whether you get joy or it gives you agony and you hate it. I didn't like it, right? If you told me how to sell, like, you know, go sell millions of these pens and do, I'd be like, I don't know how to sell a pen. I don't know how to do a transaction, right? There's people who are like, give me a pen to sell, give me a fan to sell, give me anything. I love doing deals. I structuring them, selling them, buying them, whatever. And so if your vision is to do something where transactions, whether you're banking, whether you're doing something, great, but make sure it gives you joy. Make sure it's a unique ability that you love doing it, that you're good at it, that you're going to keep getting better at it. For me, somebody with an identification of a problem they want to solve, I have found if you can't create a vision for what this looks like, whatever it is you see, 25 years out, what would happen, not if it happens, when it happens. And you might say, well, it's only going to take me 3 to 5 years. Like, well, okay, but what if you could work on this for the next 25? And if they don't want to, if that doesn't excite them, then you know it's the wrong thing, because it always takes, it's like any construction project, it always takes twice as long, costs twice as much money. So if you think you're going to go do a transaction and get in and out, you're betting on doing one, sadly mistaken. You might get lucky. I mean, we all know people that have, but if you don't have something that's going to entertain you, keep you motivated, self-motivated, by the way, keep you excited, keep you curious, keep you challenged, if you don't see that, then it's not don't do it, it's work on it and see if you can create a vision that goes out 25 years. And some people are like, well, I want to sell it before. They're like, okay, that's okay. But if you have a 25-year vision and someone takes you out in year 5 or 10, and you know what, it was so much money or whatever, great. But people are attracted to vision and to a journey they might be on with you to make money, to accomplish that. For my world and what I've done for the last 15 years, going back to your question, you know, 45 minutes ago, Jesse, around what, you know, what is Startup Health? We've built Startup Health to be an organization on a mission to inspire and educate a global army of entrepreneurs trying to solve the biggest health challenges in the world. And we've determined that, and it seems obvious now, even in hindsight, that with solving some of the biggest challenges in the world are some of the biggest opportunities in the world. And so you can kind of look at that and say, that's something probably is going to take a lot more than 25 years. It could take a century, right? Like the Chan Zuckerberg vision is 100 years eliminating disease, but it attracts people that want to do it with you. And what I found about having a big vision is if you have an inspiring mission or vision on what you're doing, regardless, you will find other people who are attracted to that. You will also repel people, which is perfect, because you don't want anybody who doesn't want to be involved long term. And if you have a long term vision like that, not only do you attract them, you also want to choose them right, that filter. And so I think if you have an idea for doing something, ask yourself, what is the impact if we keep going with this? If you keep going, okay, so you do that, then what? Then what? Then what? And can you create a 25-year vision out of your idea? And really, Startup Health not only had a 25-year vision we launched, I continue to keep, we have a 25-year vision from now. Like, we keep that framework. And by the way, you definitely choose to do different things when you're going to be doing it for a long time, because you don't have the wherewithal, nor do the people around you, to do anything to take away from being able to stay the whole course and not burn out.
So Steve, you know the R factor question?
Of course. Dan Sullivan, going back to strategic coach, had this framework of, it's a play on the SWOT analysis that you learn in business school or in business courses in college, which is ask a question about the future. And you could pick 3 years, you could do shorter, you could do longer, but the idea is to see if you're going to be involved with somebody long-term. You say, what has to happen 3 years from today? If we were sitting there talking, having coffee, having dinner, what has to happen for you to feel happy with your progress? And then what comes from that results question, which is what R factor means, results that you're looking for. What are the three biggest challenges or dangers standing in your way? What are the three biggest opportunities you have to capture? And what are your three biggest strengths you're going to leverage? And so you could do that at any point in time in your life. You could do it every quarter. You could do it with a customer. You could do it with anyone. But it really shakes the trees on what really people are focused on, the fear, the excitement, and the confidence.
So where I was going with that, Steve, and thank you so much for explaining what it is that every time I've ever used that question, and what I'm looking for is if you're going to potentially work with me on my vision for 5 years, for 3 years, for 1 year, if I ask that question and I'm not in your future vision of what's going to happen a year from now, if I'm not part of that, you're not seeing a future with me. And that is an amazing way to expunge people who may interview amazingly, but they, and by the way, every time I've overlooked this, when somebody's actually told me the real answer to that question, like in 3 years from now, I'm going to have my own agency. That's a bad answer if you're coming to work for me as my COO. And I have received that very answer and I overlooked that very answer and that same party left within about a year or 2 years. So it's a very insightful question to ask other people to see if they see you in their futures.
It's amazing how these little tools or frameworks help think about your thinking, think about who you're surrounding yourselves with. And there's just a few things, if you practice them, they work. And I think what you're describing is the dialogue of really taking ownership of who you surround yourself with, who works for you, who invests in you, who partners with you, who you spend your time with. And I, you know, the R factor question, it's funny. It's a simple question that sounds really oversimplistic. But you're right. People tell you. It's not even like they're trying to hide it. And some people are like, oh, that's a great question. And then they vomit out the answer. And by the way, it's not the wrong answer. It's just the truth. It might not be the right fit for you. And so the more you can ask those kinds of questions, the better off you are at helping not just create value for yourself, but create value for them as well. Because it might be, Brian, that somebody answers that and you're like, you know what? That's great. If you come here for 2 years, I will help you start that agency. Because I believe in creating leaders, right? I'm pretending for a second that might be exactly what you're looking for, a young entrepreneur to come in, not only learn from you, help you, but you're going to go help them. And now you're going to be involved with what his future is. But if you're not, stop now.
And the only other question that I think Dan Sullivan came up with that really kind of blew me away is, who do you want to be a hero to?
I love that. I love that question. That, by the way, that stumps everybody, because you want to explain it, Dad, Brian? Because I love the framework.
And after you explain it, Dad, I want you, Steve, to, maybe that'll be our closing thing. What is the meaning of life? And then who do you want to be a hero to?
So I'm going to let Steve answer these questions to start. Like, who did you choose to be a hero to? And from your perspective at this age, what do you think the meaning of and purpose of why we're here is?
So the framework of who do you want to be a hero to is, who do you want to help, and how do you want to spend your time in whether it's in life or in business? And so the question and why it's so important in business is, who do you want your customer to be? And that's the framework of who do you want to be a hero to, because you want to be a hero to your customers. And choosing who you want to be a hero to can define a lot and help you figure out exactly who you want to quote unquote serve and work with and spend time with. And for me, At the very beginning of being answering that question, it was entrepreneurs. And in, before I started Startup Health, it was just, I love being around entrepreneurs, helping entrepreneurs. I want to be a hero to entrepreneurs. And I found myself, interestingly enough, in a business, the predecessor to Startup Health, Organized Wisdom, not helping entrepreneurs. We were helping pharma companies and advertisers and do all this stuff. And I get no joy out of it. And I went back and asked myself the question, who do I want to be a hero to? And one of our board members, Jerry Levin, who was the former CEO of Time Warner, was in our board meeting, as was Jason Finger from Seamless Web, my business partner, Unity, and one of my friends who's also on my board, Wayne Kimmel, and a few others. And the question came up in 2010. This was, you know, about a year before we launched Startup Health. And I was describing how difficult it is building a, it was a digital health company in, you know, in the 2007, 2010 timeframe. And I said, you know, I really don't love where Organized Wisdom has gone with who we're serving. I don't love being a hero to advertisers and agencies and pharma companies. Not for me. I know it's for a lot of people, but it's not for me. But I see entrepreneurs and I become friends with so many entrepreneurs who need help. And I think we can help them. And I think we can provide community. I think we could provide coaching. I think we could provide confidence. I think we could provide a unique thought partnership to these entrepreneurs. And I would love nothing more than to be a hero to entrepreneurs who are like me, trying to change healthcare, trying to solve big challenges. And quite frankly, I give Jerry credit for saying, well, then let's go do it. And we pivoted Organized Wisdom into Startup Health. We made our mission about this global army of entrepreneurs. And today, to the same exact, probably even more passionate about this being my hero, our hero at Startup Health, we want to be a hero to entrepreneurs who want to solve the world's biggest health challenges, who want to do it as part of a community, who have a growth mindset or a transformational mindset, and who take the long-term view that although it's going to take a long time, it's possible. And so we continue to curate that, right? It's like you find that certain people snuck in that don't want to do that. You find that people come in and they're not really committed that long. You find yourself helping and serving people who are not entrepreneurs. And all of a sudden you're like, well, let me take a step back. I want to help entrepreneurs. And the people that the entrepreneurs want to help are the patients and the families and the organizations, which is awesome because we can help 8 billion people through these entrepreneurs. I don't want to build a healthcare company. I want to help entrepreneurs build their healthcare company. And whether that's digital health or biotech or life science, I just love, love, love entrepreneurs. And that's exactly how we continue to refine and stay focused. And by the way, recalibrate to make sure we're always serving the hero and being a hero to the people we want to. And thankfully, they want to be a hero to other people. And this whole thing works because everybody stays in their lane and tries to do that. And it's nothing like being with entrepreneurs who want to be a part of that kind of ecosystem.
So let's end it off with like kind of a shallow question. What is the meaning of life?
I had to keep coming back to probably such an influential person and thought partner in my life, which is Dan Sullivan, which ironically is that idea of freedom. Freedom to me is the ideal definition of what the purpose of life is, and freedom of time and how you spend your time, freedom of relationships and who you spend your time with, freedom of purpose and what you work on and get to spend your time on, freedom of money so that you can do what you want, where you want, and how you want, and freedom of health so that you can live a long life and be there for all those wonderful things, whether it's your family or your other accomplishments and being able to see as much of this game play out, right? So being able to say, I want to be a 100-year-old person with a great health span, not just lifespan, who has freedom and shows other people how to have that same freedom. And for me, the idea of that freedom kind of underpins every decision we make because I never will give up that freedom. And that helps guide for me what I think is inherent in the meaning, again, for everybody around me as well, because I hope I have the ability to have and show them the freedom through my freedom. Brian, I have to ask you, this has been me on the firing line. What's your meaning of life?
I would say the only person that I'm in competition with is who I was yesterday. And my meaning and purpose of life is to become the best possible version of Brian K. that I'm capable of becoming. And, you know, basically share whatever lessons I learn on the path with like-minded friends and family who are also trying to become the best versions of themselves while they're on this planet. and to leave it a little bit better than I found it.
Love it. Jesse, I want to hear your answer.
You know what? It's changed a lot because 4 years ago, it was like, I don't know, do something cool and make money and figure it out. And then it evolved a little bit to mature as a person. And now the one that I align with that I really like, I don't know if you watched McConaughey's speech at the Oscars or whatever it was, where basically he said he wanted his hero to be himself from 10 years ago, and he knows he'll never reach that. But today he can look 10 years ahead and hope that that person's his hero. And then there's a never-ending chase to be a better version of yourself. So that's my more mature one now. I'm sure that'll change again. But I like that idea of, like, you want to be the person that 5 years ago you would have dreamed of being, but you know you'll never get to the full extent. And it's a never-ending sort of how you talk in quarters. You can think 20 quarters out and keep being a better version of yourself and chase different goals.
Love it. All right. So when I end every meeting, every podcast, every interview, I ask whoever it is I'm talking to for their biggest insight of the past half hour. So I'm going to ask you both what your biggest insight of today's session was.
First off, it's great having somebody that can fuck with my dad, because that needs to be used. And so that's a great insight to start off with. But really, I like the journey of going through, like, you've been on both sides, from founding, going public, advising companies, working on different companies on your own. I just think it's a unique perspective that a lot of kids, especially my age, their goal is, I want to go IPO and have a $200 million company. And I think a lot of people realize that on paper, that sounds great, but in reality, different goals and different ways of doing it is probably a more efficient way depending on the person.
Mine is that I've sat through, like, I mean, Steve, we've known each other since, I don't know if it's like 24, 25, whatever the exit.
I think it's 27 years, 95.
Okay. So for 27 years, so you're like, you know, I got to spend 20, like, I've done a 25 year framework with you. And, what I find fascinating to have an opportunity to do a podcast with you 25, 27 years later is just it, like, the maturity of a 50-something-year-old entrepreneur or man who's been devoted to entrepreneurship, coaching, and family, is that what was meaningful to us in our 20s is so not meaningful at this age. And the real reason you still do what you do, you know, is not at all what you thought was going to be the reason that you still do what you do. Like, it's like both of us are still fascinated and curious, and batteries included. And there's a lot of bitter people that are billionaires, you know?
Oh my God, so many.
But what I think is just super cool is, like, you are a perpetual student and you are always looking to be coached to that next level. And I don't think it ever ends. And I give you total props for remaining in that space, because it keeps you mentally young. And that's all we can do while we're here.
Well, I'm grateful for our friendship. I'm grateful for being among your first guests of your podcast series. I think it's incredibly unique, by the way. Bookends for you guys to be at the beginning of your entrepreneur career, Jesse. Halfway through your entrepreneur career, Brian. Only halfway through, brother.
I thought you were gonna call him old.
No, halfway, man. We're just halfway, Jess. You know, this is a journey that I think we're all privileged to be on. But I love the fact that you're doing this together, a father son podcast on entrepreneurship, asking tough questions and getting the perspectives, and having this not just be the questions, quite frankly, from a 50-something-year-old entrepreneur, but a 20-something-year-old entrepreneur. I think you guys are onto something really big, and look forward to watching this grow, and hopefully you'll have me back one day.
Awesome. Thank you, Stephen.
All right. Love you guys.
Love you, man.
Steve, thanks for your time. Thanks for your mentorship. I really appreciate it, and we'll have you back soon.